Welcome to The Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth, best-selling author and co-creator of PaleoParents.com, where we focus on real-life solutions for families seeking health.
I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, New York Times best-selling author and creator of ThePaleoMom.com. I'm passionate about improving scientific literacy around public health topics.
I like hashtags and bone broth.
And I'm just a super nerd.
Hi, Paleo View listeners. We're back. I know some of you are thinking, like, maybe they need to take a break, but no, we're committed. We're here for you.
You know, you sound like I mean, I think, as you know, the podcasts that I subscribe to, and I don't actually listen to paleo podcasts anymore. I listen to, like, completely not this sphere, get to just switch my brain into a different direction, like, arena of podcasts. And if they ever, like, miss one of their normal podcasting days, like, I listen to a couple that are once a week and a couple that are twice a week, like, I don't know what to do with myself. Like, it's become such a part of my normal routine to listen to these podcasts at, like, specific times that if they miss a week, or if my schedule for some reason gets mixed up and I don't get to listen to that podcast at my normal time, it really throws me for a loop. Like, it's become, I don't know, like a circadian rhythm signal or something, in the sense that my body is just so attuned to, like, well, no, I'm supposed to be listening to this podcast when I, you know, drive on this day to this thing. This is just what happens. I can imagine that some of our listeners are at least fairly well,
all two of them,
into the routine, right? There's two of our listeners are really in the routine. They listen to our podcast at a specific time, doing, like, the same thing every single week. And those two people know what I'm talking about. It's basically what we're saying.
All right. Well, I have a couple of announcements.
Oh, I like announcements.
Can you hold on to your hats, ladies and gentlemen? First and foremost, my blog has been hacked. But don't you worry.
That's the kind of good announcement.
Don't you worry. We fixed it. So if you went to the blog last week and you were like, oh, this is not good, I'm getting away from this, you can come back now. It's okay. We fixed
it. What did the hackers actually, like, do something, or did they just try to, like, ransomware you?
Yeah. No, they put phishing malware on the blog front page. So if you came to it, this pop-up window came that was asking you to enter information that I hope none of you entered. And it also locked up your whole web browser so that window made it so that you couldn't shut it down until you completed it, or hopefully you Control-Alt-Deleted out of it. But anyway, thankfully, we have awesome, awesome people who visit our blog who informed us of this problem, because it's not like we regularly go to the front end of our blog. And then we got it taken care of, so you can go back to the blog. It's safe now. And I have figured a workaround for my social media, because social media now thinks that we are also spam bots because of how many links we had in our social media to a phishing malware website. And so, yeah, it's a thing. So I have a workaround for both Instagram and Facebook until they get back to the 1,000 reports that we filed that this is a false problem. But just 10 minutes ago, I figured a workaround for Instagram. I'd figured the workaround for Facebook, like, a couple days ago, but I just figured out the workaround for Instagram, which is my platform. Like, that's my safe space, you know, that's where I enjoy hanging out. So the fact that I couldn't post or comment or like was physical torture. It was like stress and anxiety and all kinds of stuff. And so I'm back and I'm feeling so good. That's my first announcement.
Do I hear jazz hands?
You totally heard jazz hands.
I think I heard some jazz hands.
Totally heard jazz hands. All right. So the news just gets better.
I almost heard a little Gloria Gaynor there, but we didn't go there. So we're good.
Yeah. I gotta work up to the super extra goodness. Okay, announcement number two. I finished the career day presentation for Kohl's Middle School, whereby I was asked to speak on being a web celebrity. Ha ha ha, that's my self-depreciating title there, i.e. how to make a career out of interneting. And the stress on that was also ridiculously high. I am so nervous about being in front of a room of judgmental eighth graders. And I think it really goes back to, like, actually being in eighth grade and the fear that you have of, like, so many mean girls. Yeah, so I finished that
presentation. I was bullied ruthlessly in eighth grade. Like, eighth grade was my, like, worst.
It was my worst grade as well. Yes, for sure.
And there's a lot of horrible, horrible things that I had to go through in eighth grade that I came out stronger on the other side, but I would not wish that on anyone. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's about how I'm feeling about walking in there tomorrow. It's either going to go really well or it's going to go really badly. So we'll see.
What about a, you know, travel mug full of some adult beverage?
I don't think you can bring that onto school property. But maybe in my morning coffee before I head over, you know.
Cleverly disguised as coffee.
Yeah, and then they're like, oh, this career, you have a drinking problem. No. Yeah, probably not a good thing. So when I was doing my presentation for the school career day, I got to write something that is the third really good news. Are you ready? Because, girl, I'm telling you got to be ready. There's going to be so many jazz hands, and okay. Matt's going to need to put in Gloria Gaynor clips and all kinds of goodness. Are you ready?
All right. My hands are free. I have put the pen down. I'm good.
One of the statistics that I included about my success in the internet world is that I am part of a top-rated, syndicated podcast with over 5 million downloads.
Whoa! Holy smokes! I did. I totally started jazz handing away as soon as you said 5 million. Holy smokes, guys! That's a lot of downloads for, like, 6 listeners, right?
Right, I know. Those 2 listeners
just keep telling over and over.
I don't know how many devices they've purchased. You know? My mom and your mom. That's it.
Well, I think this is a nice segue to saying thank you, listeners, because you are the reason why we keep coming back. It's kind of a strange, we have a really tight friendship through podcasting, but it's the kind of friendship, because we live so far apart, that if we weren't actually talking as we record a podcast every single week, we would probably, you know, not actually be in this close of contact. And so not only can I thank you guys for your engagement and your connection and making this feel like such a worthwhile venture and really helping us to educate and help people regain their health and have this amazing, you know, impact on the world, but also thank you for supporting this wonderful friendship that Stacey and I have developed over the years. I don't think we would have without this podcast. This podcast is the routine for us that gets us talking every week. And I want to shout out to that too.
Thank you. I could not agree more. And I will say that our friendship and our patience with each other, I think, also helps make us better podcasters and better people. I was in a really dark place Sunday because that's when the blog was hacked. Like, just a number of really traumatic things happening. And I was texting Sarah, and I was just like, listen, FYI, I'm going to be in bad mood tonight, okay? She's like, maybe we should reschedule.
Well, I was just like, here's my availability. Do you have any overlapping availability that's maybe not tonight when you're having a grown-up temper tantrum, which are totally valid? All grown-ups have temper tantrums.
I think it went something like, but I have to do this, and I have to do this. And so that's why it's 3 days later, and I'm in so much better mood.
There were a couple text messages that I think challenged the character maximum of text messages. But, no, I mean, that's... I mean, what you hear, listeners, in terms of our interaction is completely genuine. And it's something that to me, I love everything about podcasting, except, okay, I don't love the later bedtimes when we.
The time commitment isn't my favorite, but the reason that we do it is because of you.
And everything else, because our podcast listeners are the best people. When we go to conferences, signings, any kind of event, it's always the podcast listeners that are the most engaged. They're the ones who know us well. We have amazing conversations, an amazing connection. And it's just such an amazing way to communicate with people that I certainly find is very different from anything else that I do. This way of verbal communication as opposed to written, right? It just, there's so much more ability to emote and share passion in the way that we phrase things that just doesn't come through in a blog post or a social media post, if you know what I mean?
Yes, I do know what you mean. I totally know what you mean. So one of the places that we have met some of these awesome listeners is at Paleo Effects. Are you going to maybe ask our listeners if they're going?
Yes. Are you going? Because I'm going and I'm really, really excited to meet you or see you again if we've met before. Paleo Effects is this coming week by the time this airs. So it's, or I guess next weekend, or it's the end of April, and it really is one of my favorite events. I go to it every year. This year I am doing a talk on gut health, and I'm just about done. So I'm also really, really excited that I'm very like organized this year, because I haven't always been organized every single year I've gone to Paleo Effects, but this year I seem to be learning the hard way and being a little bit more proactive in terms of developing my slides for my talks. But I'm also speaking at the satellite event Health Entrepreneurs FX, which is on Thursday. And these are two amazing events. So Health Entrepreneurs is really designed for people who are launching and running businesses within the paleo and alternative health communities. But there's a pretty diverse range of people who go to that. So it goes everywhere from people who have a product they want to launch, or they have a product and they're just looking to expand. I've met people who are looking to fulfill sort of lobbying roles, and also bloggers who are just looking to understand how to build their audience and monetize their blog will also go to this event. So it's a really, really amazing event. We do small talks on specific subjects, and then we do these small group sort of breakout sessions where we do sort of small group workshops within the bigger event. And it's like a full day from 8 a.m. till 10 p.m. And it's just packed with amazing, amazing tidbits of information. I always learn new stuff when I go there. And I'm going to be doing a talk that's really specifically about specific concerns in terms of protecting health for entrepreneurs, because it is sort of a different challenge to make time for things that are really, really important from a physical health perspective within an entrepreneur type lifestyle. So that's what I'm going to be talking about. But there's going to be a lot of, a lot of talks about marketing and audience building and monetization, and also, it's a really amazing networking experience. So if there's specific connections that you want to make, Health Entrepreneurs FX is a really, really great event if you are on that sort of more businessy side of things. And then Paleo FX is just, what I love about this conference is there's a lot of science in it, but it's always with this like practical what do I take home from this and do aspect. It has an amazing vendor floor with there's always some like new startup company with some amazing new product that I find there, or three or four. And if you can, if you are a person who loves to be spontaneous and just like buy tickets and fly to Austin, Texas with like a couple days notice, you can save 35% on your ticket to the Paleo FX event with the code MOM35, M-O-M-3-5. So that helps make a last minute travel a little bit more affordable. But it's just such a fantastic event. And if you know that like travel on 2 days notice is not your thing, this year I'm penciled in for next year, because it really is an amazing event, and I do go every year. I love it. And this year I'm going to be really easy to find, because I'm going to be hanging out at booth, I believe it's booth 17 in back, for most of the conference. If I'm not on stage in a panel or talking, that's where I intend to be, with a new company that I'm supporting their launch of, called Strength in Food, which is really, really exciting. And I'll tell you guys all about that more next week, or maybe the week after, once launch is actually official. But that's really, really exciting. So I'm going to be really easy to find, and just come hang out. We're going to have free water at our booth. We're going to have cell phone charging stations. We're going to have food samplings. We're going to have me to hang out with. Hopefully that's a draw. And so I'm really looking forward to seeing you. Please come by and say hi. And I'm excited about it. It's such a dynamic event, and it's not like anything else that I do all year. So I'm gearing up for it.
I can hear your jazz hands.
There was jazz hands, and there was also one of those like kayuk, like punching the upwards thing. What
did you call that? Raising the roof?
No, that's this one. Raise the roof is this one. It's more like a, I don't know, where you like, yeah.
This is just going downhill really fast. What's our topic this week?
We have a topic. This topic this week, we were sort of having a conversation about what to cover. And I mentioned that I had just spent like weeks finishing up a pretty epic science nerdy blog post on EMFs, or electromagnetic fields. And I believe you said, hey, we should do that in the podcast.
Yeah. I think my comment was, let's do that one. Cause I personally, as our listeners know, if they've been listening for a while, selfishly choose the topics that I'm interested in.
Well, and this is something that I get asked about all the time. You know, I'm sure we have at least 12 questions about electromagnetic fields in our podcast inbox. But I didn't grab any today, because I just felt like this is such a big topic. I just kind of wanted to go through it fairly methodically. And then if we have follow-up questions, you can tackle that in future podcasts. But it's something that has become this sort of buzzword. I think in the same way that candida and leaky gut have become a buzzword, and there are a lot of people, and because of websites that, you know, spout to this effect, who believe that EMFs are the source of their health problems, who you go to quite extensive lengths to avoid EMF exposure, who are spending a fortune on shields to protect themselves against EMFs. And there's this sort of growing list of sort of these, you know, the pseudoscience blog articles, website articles that we see on a lot of varying topics that we cover on this show, that are really pointing to electromagnetic fields as being sort of like the scourge of human existence, and the true cause for the rise in chronic illness. And I wanted to go through the scientific literature, because there really are a lot of really big, rigorously done studies evaluating the health effects of electromagnetic field radiation. And I really wanted to sort of tease out where the grain of truth is behind some of those anti-EMF claims, and where there really isn't science to support those claims, and give people like, here's the protections that make sense, and here's the stuff where you're wasting your money. And I think it's one of those things that you know, these very conspiracy type articles, the reason why they're so compelling, and this is becoming such a big buzzword, is because there is this grain of scientific truth. And I think it's really important to sort of honor that, you know, we do have some data showing that in a very specific situation, we want to exert some caution and everything else. I mean, here, spoiler alert, everything else is really a non-issue. But let's take a step back and really talk about, like, what do we mean when we say EMFs? So I've already mentioned EMF stands for electromagnetic field. That is any of a bunch of different types of radiation or are electromagnetic radiation. The field part just means that it's sort of like temperature, right? You can measure temperature at any point in space, and temperature changes on a gradient. So you can measure it, move your thermometer an inch and measure it, and it'll be slightly different if you're going towards a heat source or away from a heat source. So an electromagnetic field is like that in the sense that it has a measurable quantity at every point in space, and it changes in strength depending on how far away you are from the source of that electromagnetic field or that electromagnetic radiation. But electromagnetic radiation really just means that you have some kind of particle traveling through space, typically a charged particle. But for example, visible light is a form of electromagnetic radiation, and it's from the movement of photons, which are not charged. So movement of a particle or movement of some kind of charge causes this electromagnetic radiation. And there's a variety of different types, and they are separated based on a frequency or wavelength. So wavelength and frequency are inversely proportional to each other. So you can say something with a very long wavelength, a very low wavelength, has a very low frequency, long wavelength, or very short wavelength is very high frequency. And visible light sort of falls in this very narrow spectrum. In terms of lower frequency radiation, that we've got things like mobile phones, microwaves, radios, computers, power lines. This is a lot of the things that people are concerned about when we talk about EMFs. Higher frequency than visible light, we've got things like X-rays, gamma rays, UV radiation. And one of the reasons why I kind of wanted to separate those out, we're going to put a link to my blog post in the show notes so that you can read this, see the scientific citations, see some of the graphics that are in that post to help explain. But when you get higher frequency, so a shorter wavelength than visible light, you're typically getting towards a type of radiation that's more likely to be ionizing. And when you're a longer wavelength or a lower frequency from visible light, you tend to have radiation that is non-ionizing. And that is a really important difference. So ionizing radiation, like X-rays or like ultraviolet radiation from the sun, what ionizing means is that actually this radiation has enough energy that when it hits an atom, it can knock an electron off. And so that ionizes that atom. So an ion is an atom that's missing an electron that it would normally have. And so that actually, when we have that type of radiation hit our bodies, for example, in UVB rays from the sun, that can cause damage to our DNA. And when enough damage to DNA builds up, that increases risk of cancer because it increases the chances of that cell basically not being able to grow or divide properly. So it undergoes something called transformation, which basically means it loses the ability to be the type of cell that it is, and it becomes a cancer cell. So ionizing radiation really is a concern for human health. Non-ionizing radiation is not high enough energy to ionize an atom, so it can't actually change the molecular structure of an atom. So this encompasses most of the types of radiation that we're exposed to on a day-to-day basis. It's non-ionizing radiation. And everything, you know, when we talk about EMFs as the sort of buzzword as opposed to like the physics technical term, when we talk about EMFs in terms of, you know, health concerns due to EMF exposure, what we're talking about is all of these very low frequency non-ionizing radiations that we are exposed to at very low levels, but kind of chronically, because we live in a world where we use devices that use electricity. So anytime you have a moving charge, like an electron, that electron emits electromagnetic radiation. So what's really interesting is we have these collections of very large studies, and studies that have been done by nonpartisan groups, so basic science research, or done by committees, you know, societies, academies that are not funded with industrial money. So like really just non-biased research that actually dates back to the 1970s. There's a tremendous body of research looking at EMFs and looking at different kinds. So looking at, you know, looking at what type of exposure we're getting, and how much exposure causes a problem. And what's interesting is that we have, you know, we have rodent studies trying to replicate it. We have human studies. So there really is a huge amount of data. In rodents, the cusp of exposure to electromagnetic fields, in terms of how that would correlate to a human's exposure, we see health problems at approximately 25,000 times more radiation than what we get on average. So what we can say from animal studies is that the amount that we're getting is much, 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 much lower than the cusp that's causing health problems, like increased cancer in animals. And that's kind of important because when you're translating cancer studies from rodents to humans, rodents are typically much more resilient than humans. We're actually a sort of a more fragile species from a cancer perspective. When you're doing animal studies in rodents, typically if you're applying some kind of toxin, typically you are applying, you know, 100 times more, 1,000 times more than what's actually required. So we can correct a little bit for this or say, okay, well, the rats are getting 25,000 times more radiation than we're getting. How does that correlate to humans? It still is such a big number beyond what we get that we're still in this very, very, like, this is not equivalent. So we can really say that that it's, that data at least indicates that we should not be worried about it from a cancer perspective. In terms of the human studies that have looked at whether or not there is a link between electromagnetic field exposure and cancer incidence, the ones that have looked at that have been sort of the most similar to what those rodent studies are looked at people who live close to power lines. And what's actually really interesting there is that most of the studies have shown there's no association. That's the majority of the findings. There's been a couple that have shown a very, very small increase in childhood leukemia for only children with extremely high levels of exposure. So exposure that you would only get if you were extremely close to a power line. Those power lines are really, really strong, like those giant ones. And you live there all the time, you never get away. So, and not even all of the studies have shown that particular link. So it's a very, very small percentage of children who are exposed to that level. And that small percentage of children have a small increased chance of childhood leukemia. So that's one of the little grains of truth. Studies that have looked at other types of EMF exposure, that's a little bit more of a everyday exposure for people, like Wi-Fi in classrooms, like Bluetooth, have shown zero, and very uniformly big rigorous studies have shown a zero increased risk of cancer from those studies. But power line workers, people who have occupational exposure, they're hitting these sort of cusps of very, very high exposure where they do have increased cancer risk. So we have this sort of like, what is a regular person exposed to, and what is a strange situation where someone might be exposed to very, very high levels. So people who are exposed to these very, very high levels do have an increased risk of cancer. What's interesting, and we'll get into this in some of the cell phone studies, is that even in these sort of power line, electrical occupations, right? These electrical occupations that have higher exposure. We see this increased cancer risk at very, very high levels of exposure, but in this sort of moderate range, we actually see decreased cancer risk. So I know when I was first first doing the research for this, it was based on a conversation that I'd had with a visiting professor when I was doing second postdoctoral research fellowship at the University of Arizona. And this topic had come up over lunch. And it was such an impactful conversation that I still remember it. So, you know, a decade later, and I'm researching this for an article for my blog in a completely different, you know, career now. And this conversation comes back to me. And they had just finished, you know, reviewing this paper that had been looking at cancer risks of people living close to power lines, and showed that the closer to a power line you lived, the lower your risk of cancer. And they were just blown away. They thought it was so neat. And so it was actually tracking down those research papers that started me on this entire research project. There have been some other more recent studies that have both confirmed that and added it to this idea of like very, very high levels of exposure can increase cancer risk. But cell phones are probably one of the biggest concerns for people, because we've become this like cell phone, I don't even want to say addicted, I think dependent, a cell phone dependent society. And cell phones have just become, I mean, everybody has one. Kids have them. Like, it's, we're all carrying it around. We've got it in our pockets. We're sleeping with them in our bedside table. Sometimes there's sleep apps where it requires the bed to be like under, or the phone to be in the bed with you or under your pillow. So this becomes a more relevant question just because it's some exposure that we really are all exposed to. And there have been a couple of very, very large studies that have looked at cancer risk and different types of cancer with cell phone use. And interestingly, there is some data in terms of brain tumors, not all carcinogenic brain tumors. Some of them are benign. So the Interphone study was a very, very large study. And interestingly enough, showed no increased risk of brain tumors with high cell phone use. And the lowest risk of brain tumor was actually in like the second to highest group of cell phone users. So there's some, their data would imply that there's some protective effect with cell phone use. They also showed.
What do they think that mechanism is?
Well, so it's interesting because electromagnetic fields are being used more and more in medical therapies. So there's this whole separate side of research that is understanding electromagnetic field effects on cellular health. And overall, they're used to improve cellular health. So they can actually basically help rev up the mitochondria in a cell. So it helps a cell kind of go through this autophagy spring cleaning and improve its ATP production, which overall improves cellular health. And there's a variety of new sort of medical therapies that are being based on this particular information. And this is probably, it's probably translates to, you know, in terms of evolution, the fact that we were outside all the time. So we were exposed to a lot more electromagnetic radiation from the sun. I mean, the Earth has magnetic poles. So the Earth has an electromagnetic field. Cosmic radiation is electromagnetic radiation that we're exposed to all the time. So we actually have evolved being exposed to natural sources of electromagnetic radiation. And by putting ourselves indoors, we've actually, in some ways, reduced our exposure. We've reduced our exposure to natural sources of electromagnetic radiation while increasing our exposure to sort of more organized sources of electromagnetic radiation with electric devices. So there's this whole separate field of research that's trying to understand different wavelengths of electromagnetic radiation, how those can actually be used therapeutically. So it's an interesting idea of like you're depositing energy, but not enough energy to alter molecular structure. So you can think of it in sort of many of the same benefits that you get from sun exposure, from sunlight, but not obviously the UVB radiation, which is the one that increases skin cancer. We get a lot of benefits from photobiomodulation therapies, and that's sort of the same idea, but within typically infrared and visible wavelengths or infrared saunas. That's a type of electromagnetic field. So those are all, I mean, infrared isn't, but a lot of the other ones are in the visible wavelength. Infrared is subvisible. But there seems to be some benefits to cellular health with some of this very, very low level energy deposition, not enough energy to change molecular structures, but there is some energy being deposited into our tissues. And what's really interesting to me with this type is certainly there's a few other studies that do show some increased risk of brain tumors, but there always seems to be this like moderate exposure range where we see a reduced risk. So the Interphone study overall showed no increased risk, and there was a, you know, moderate cell phone use showed decreased risk of deep brain cancers, which is, and benign brain tumors, which is fascinating. And to the point where like one of their groups in terms of call time, and I think it was like, you know, 1,000 hours of cumulative call time over the study, but up to like 1500, something like that, had like a 50% reduction in the incidence of brain tumors, which like there's not very many things that you can do in your life that reduces your risk of something by 50%. So granted, these are very, very rare cancers to begin with. So reducing chances by 50% doesn't actually translate to a very big change in incidence. You know, like you're talking about you know, two people out of a few hundred thousand instead of three people in a few hundred thousand. Like that's the type of incidence rates we're talking about for these. But it's still a really, really interesting phenomenon. But it's not completely consistent. So the Million Women study, which was a British-based study, did show that just among their highest and longest time cell phone users, that there was an increased risk of a type of benign tumor called an acoustic neuroma. And that was about double the risk, or a little bit over double the risk for that one group. But they showed for, you know, general, like normal levels of usage compared to people who didn't use them, they actually showed about the same level of risk of glioma and meningioma, if not maybe a slightly decreased risk of glioma. It wasn't statistically significant. Again, these are such rare cancers. You need to have hundreds of thousands and millions of people in your studies to be able to get enough incidence for statistics. The Danish study also showed no increased risk of brain cancers. They actually showed a potentially decreased risk of brain cancer with sort of moderate use compared to no use. This particular study does have some design flaws because it was based on billing information. And if you're using a business phone, that's not going to reflect the number of hours that you're using. So it did have some reporting issues that could make it a little bit more challenging. But it overall showed no difference in terms of brain cancer rates. There was another French study, and Cernet. I'm pronouncing it as though it was French. Le Cernet study found no increased risk of gliomas or meningiomas for regular cell phone users versus non-users. But again, it sort of found in the super, super like high level cell phone use. We're talking about people who are using the cell phone, not using a headset. The cell phone's attached to their head for hours every day. So typically these studies show the cusp for this like higher risk of brain cancer is 1,000-ish hours, depending on the study. So at 1,000 cumulative hours over a fairly short, you know, few years period of time. So you're talking about 2-3 hours cell phone use every single day without using a headset. They had a slightly increased risk of brain cancers, gliomas and meningiomas. So 2-2.5 times higher risk.
So that doesn't measure usage, like when it's in your hand for that many hours a day, only at your brain.
So here's one of the problems that we have with these studies. So because we're talking about very rare cancers, these studies have to be done over a very long period of time. So most of these studies were started in the mid to late 90s. They have to typically run for at least 10 years to get enough data to be able to draw conclusions, because you're following people and you're seeing what habits are, and then you're following their health outcomes. And some of them have run for longer than 10 years. So you're talking about studies, some of these studies concluded in, you know, 2010, 2012, that sort of time frame, started in 95, went to 2012. Like, that's a really long, robust study. But if you recall, smartphones, you know, the first iPhone was released in late 2007. So we're looking at studies where the majority of the data in these studies comes from the older cell phones before smartphones. And we've really changed how we use smartphones or we use phones because of smartphones. So we're more likely to hold in our hand. Smartphones have speakerphone, which was not a feature on these old phones. We have headsets now. We have Bluetooth sets. We have Bluetooth in our car. We have Bluetooth speakers. We have so many different ways of talking on the phone now, where we're holding it away from our head or using the phone in a way that we didn't use it before. So that is important for a couple of reasons. One, we're not holding it to our head as much as we were. Electromagnetic radiation falls off very, very quickly with distance. Depending on how you're measuring it, it falls off as the distance squared or the distance cubed. So there's a like orders of magnitude difference between the amount of radiation getting into your brain, holding the phone up to your ear versus holding it in front of you and looking at it. Like it's, you're just, that radiation is hardly able to penetrate when you're holding the phone at arm's length compared to holding it against your head. So most researchers think that this increased risk of brain cancer that was found in some studies for only very, very high cell phone users is not actually applicable to smartphones because of that difference in how we use them. The other thing is the frequencies used were slightly different. So modern cell phones use a lower frequency. So that's also thought to be even safer because it's basically has less energy to deposit, to the point where like we might not be enjoying this, you know, modest decreased risk of brain cancer from cell phone use. But there is this sort of collection of studies that show with very, very high cell phone use, you know, hours and hours a day with older cell phones, right? Not smartphones generally. There's some smartphone data wrapped up into these big data sets, but it's mostly, you know, the older sort of flip phones, those styles of phones from the like, early 2000s, late 90s. Also, as cell phones, as we get more cell phone towers, that also lowers the amount of EMFs that are being emitted. So when a cell phone actually emits radiation is when it's communicating with a cell phone tower. So just improving the cell phone tower network actually reduces EMFs because it doesn't have to emit as much of a signal if the cell phone tower is closer. So for example, if you're trying to use your phone and it only has one bar, it is emitting a lot more radiation than your phone if it has all four bars and that little 4G beside it. So that also completely changes the equation, almost certainly for the better. So we've got this like grain of truth of, you know, kids who have extremely high exposure because they live close to power lines. Workers in the field, like power line workers, have an increased risk of some cancers. And we have these few studies showing that at least the old school cell phones in the old way that we used to use them at extremely high usage does increase risk of cancers. And it's these little bits of data that these, you know, anti-EMF, you know, websites, products, whatever, that's what they're latching onto without providing the context of, you know, there are a few studies that have really scary data, but whenever you get a study like this, especially when it's a safety concern, there's always replication studies. The replication studies can't replicate the data. And for every one study that might show, oh, you know, EMFs lower sperm counts or whatever it is, there's 10, 15, 20 studies that refute that. So the vast collection of research is showing that there's absolutely no reason to worry about this, although it is good to use a headset or, you know, whenever possible to sort of minimize the amount of time that you're holding your phone directly against your head. If you're somebody who spends a lot of time on the phone, like that little bit is probably a worthwhile precaution, but there's no evidence that we need to be turning off our Wi-Fi networks at night or disabling Bluetooth. And actually, a lot of the shields that are being sold to minimize EMF exposure actually magnify it. So that's a complete waste of money. So don't waste your money on EMF shields. And really, I mean, it's the amount of studies showing that that EMFs are, you know, some kind of concern. It's a very similar analogy to the amount of studies showing that man-made climate change isn't real. Like it really is sort of a similar comparison. The vast, vast, vast majority of research confirms EMFs are not problematic from a human health perspective, just like the vast, vast, vast amount of research points to man-made climate change being a legitimate concern. And what's interesting, sort of on a final note, is I get a lot of, you know, in part because of the AIP lecture series and communicating with so many people with chronic health problems and autoimmune disease, I get a lot of people who are concerned about EMF hypersensitivity. So they have identified some kind of reaction that they have when they're around electromagnetic fields. And there have been studies that have tried to understand what EMF hypersensitivity is. They've been double blind. So the person who, you know, says they have EMF sensitivity and joins the trial doesn't know if the electromagnetic field is being turned on or turned off. And they're sitting in, you know, some kind of Faraday cage. So there's like no electromagnetic radiation where they're sitting whatsoever when it's off. And the researcher who's running the trial also doesn't know when it's turned off or it's turned on. And in those studies, they have not been able to show any correlation between the symptoms that the person is experiencing and whether or not the electromagnetic field is turned on or off. And they haven't been able to replicate. So they haven't been able to replicate what the person reports happening when they have exposure to an electromagnetic field. And I want to just sort of emphasize for any of our listeners who feel that they may have an electromagnetic field sensitivity, that this is different than saying that you don't have symptoms. Nobody's saying that your symptoms aren't real. What this research points to is that EMFs may not be the cause because the symptoms are not reproducible in laboratory conditions. So it's kind of important to understand that there's a lot of things that can go along with electromagnetic fields that are understood as sensitivities, like flickering fluorescent lights, the glare from computer screens, bad air quality in workspaces, stressful environments, the blue light exposure from screens that can wreck sleep quality, the hum or the noise, the sort of very, very low frequency noise that some of these things can make that can disrupt sleep quality. So there's a lot of other potential explanations for the symptoms, but it isn't specifically an electromagnetic field sensitivity. There's something else that kind of goes along with an electric device that is the most probable cause. And so what the good part of that is, you're not crazy. It just means digging a little bit deeper and figuring out a little bit more of the details. And B, a lot of the precautions are probably not necessary. So depending on exactly what the mechanism is behind that for you, you know, the whole, again, the shields are fairly well, they're pretty much just a scam. There are certainly some products that claim to block EMFs that actually increase the exposure. And the effort of, you know, going and turning off the Wi-Fi before going to bed, those types of things, that is almost certainly not worthwhile. It's certainly not worthwhile for all of us who don't have any kind of symptoms when we're around electromagnetic fields. For someone who does feel some kind of symptoms, it's more likely if you're sleeping with a wireless router in your bedroom, it's more likely the LED lights that are disrupting your sleep. That can be as simple as moving it to another room. So digging a little bit deeper and seeing if some of those solutions can be simplified so that you're not going to such incredible lengths to reduce exposure, because that part is almost certainly not necessary. But it really surprised me as I dug through the research. I was not expecting the research to be as unequivocal as it was, that there's this like grain of truth with this, you know, very, very high level of exposure, increasing brain tumors. And then like, no, there's just no other, you know, any of the other sort of claims that websites make, none of else of it is borne out by the science.
So there's this internet thing that I've seen go around a bazillion times. It's a photo from a kid's science experiment where they put seeds or something, and one is like next to a router and one is not. And they show how the one next to the router dies. And what's interesting to me is I see something like that, and you know, it has a disclaimer like, these are both in the exact same conditions. I'm like, how could they be in the exact same conditions if they're in different rooms? Like, and also, what's the control on the child study? It's fascinating. Like, it's, you know, it's interesting, but hearing the science coming from you is refreshingly different than information on the internets, because I just feel like we've talked on the podcast before about how information circulates on the internets without a source. And when I see that study, like, the questions that I want to ask is, was one closer to a window? Was one overwatered or underwatered, or a variety of conditions that would affect growth? Or were the seeds diseased to begin with? Was there, how many times did you try this experiment over and over again to produce the same results? You know, different things like that. And what's interesting to me is I know that it's easy to see something like that and to think, well, this is compelling and it's interesting and it goes with my convictions of a healthy lifestyle, and therefore I want to share it. But I challenge us all to, no matter what you see or read, to question it, whether it's from us or whether it's from somebody else. Like, question all of the things that go into whatever claim is being made and what sources are being used, because, you know, I was going to ask you essentially to debunk it, and they're like, why even bother? Like, it's so basic, I'll just debunk it myself, you know?
I have to say, Snopes.com has an excellent article about it.
Interesting. So, it hadn't even occurred to me to go to Snopes, because I was like, this is silly. Like, it's just silly.
Yeah, and actually, Snopes.com is a really wonderful website that I love, because they have very, very balanced, very, very fair evaluations of, you know, sort of urban legends of all kinds, including lots of scary science fair projects, because they also have one for the microwaved water killing a plant, which is, you know, foolish. I mean, if you put it on the plant when it's still boiling, yeah, it's going to kill the roots. But there's nothing different about microwave water versus regular water. Microwave is also non-ionizing radiation. And have we ever done that on a podcast? Do we need to do a podcast about microwaves?
Way back in the day. And I don't know if it was as, you know, in-depth as you go into now. So
we can do an in-depth why microwaves are perfectly safe podcast if our listeners would like, for sure. But Snopes.com is a really excellent, because they also link to research. So if there's research that shows refute, but they'll link to news articles, they'll link to, you know, they'll all different kinds of things to sort of build the picture. And they'll also, you know, they'll give you a, you know, a yes or a no. It's, you know, busted or confirmed. It's, to me, it's very much, you know, it's proven or unproven.
For those that haven't been, it's like Mythbusters, but like Mythbusters in real life,
in written form, without Jamie and Adam, sadly, it's just not the same. but it's very much the sort of same idea, but with a little bit more rigorous, I think, science methodology behind. So they'll sometimes replicate a urban legend as well. They'll actually like do the experiment on for Snopes, but they'll do it with like a way more, you know, higher statistical sampling so they can actually run statistical analysis, which Mythbusters often had samplings of three. So let's, you know, often their conclusions were maybe not not rigorous enough to be able to like pass a peer-reviewed journal's, you know, criteria. But still, Adam and Jamie, obviously. I mean, the B team's awesome too. I'm just saying, I'm a big Mythbusters fan as well. It's amazing. I miss them. I wish they would come back. But yes, Snopes.com, excellent source for things. And also, you know, I do, especially when it's in this sphere, I don't like to venture out of sort of health and wellness, diet and lifestyle too far. And there's certain things where, you know, if I got into, you know, talking about every single medication, I would just talk about pharmaceuticals for the rest of my life. But whenever it's these types of topics, I do try to write very in-depth articles. Obviously, I don't have the team of writers that Snopes has, because it's just me. But I do try to provide a balanced and reflective of the body of scientific literature article.
Which we all appreciate. And I know how much effort it takes. So thank you for covering this topic. As a final reminder, I just want to encourage our listeners to remember that just because you read something on the internet doesn't mean it's true. There's a couple of particular blog posts that get circulated regularly to me and ask for my opinion on it about this particular topic, with people saying that removing these devices has changed their lives and their health and all that kind of stuff. It's interesting, Sarah, that you would specifically bring up something like LED making a difference, or
there's also some psychology.
I was about to say, because right? My perspective has always been more the power of positive thinking and the belief that you will feel better is a powerful tool for a lot of people to actualize that result. And so from my perspective, that's always kind of how I'd considered it. But your introduction of the idea of it could just be that by removing that thing, they no longer have LED lights, their sleep is no longer disrupted, which makes a big difference in their health. And that to me makes a lot of sense. So I appreciated that perspective as well.
Well, I just want to add to what you just said, because there is a separate psychology aspect, which is you know, internet addiction, smartphone addiction. There are studies now that are describing this as psychological conditions, social media. There's a variety of studies showing that if you are a person with a tendency towards depression, that time on social media can magnify that quite dramatically. So it doesn't seem to cause depression, but if you're already someone with depressive tendencies, it can magnify and drive it. There's a bunch of studies looking at now at smartphone addiction. I heard a really wonderful story on NPR a few weeks ago about turning your screen to grayscale, to black and white, and how that can break addiction, because everything is so designed to be so stimulating with all of the colors that we see on our smartphones now. And so there's this whole other side of, you know, when you decide you're going to put this thing down, reduce your EMF exposure, you're also kind of going cold turkey from a potential addiction, or you're removing a potential stressor in your life. I know, you know, a few years ago when my husband and I were trying to decide if we would have a third kid, and I really wanted a third child. He was not on board, and we ended up, you know, deciding together not to. But it felt like to me like every single person I had ever known in my entire life was on Facebook with a baby bump, and it drove me so crazy. I like gave up Facebook at that point. It was so magnifying my, you know, not just my emotions, but like the the confusion and the, you know, just not really knowing what the right decision was, like that whole angst aspect of it. And so there's an aspect of these other things that happen when you decide to reduce your EMF exposure by, you know, not using your cell phone anymore, not watching television, not being in front of your computer. You're avoiding a lot of things that are stimulating, a lot of things that are potential psychological stressors. You're going cold turkey from potential addictions, and you're also, you know, reducing LED exposure and like all of these other things that are a little bit more physical than psychological. But I think there's a lot of things that, you know, there's, you know, the internet and technology is the most amazing thing, but it's not 100% awesome. Like, we really need to understand how to use it smartly and judiciously to get all the benefits from it without having these negative consequences.
And with that, mic drop.
Done.
Thank you so much for tuning in this week to The Paleo View. And if you enjoyed the show or you found it interesting, please share it with friends, family, colleagues. And we love your referrals because they help us reach more people to share our message of a healthy living.
And keep deleting the podcast episode and then re-download, delete and then re-download and then delete and then re-download, because that's obviously ranking up really fast. Like, awesome.
Thanks, moms, for the 5 million downloads.
That's awesome.
And if you haven't yet left us a review in iTunes or however you are listening to the podcast, we would greatly appreciate you taking the time to do that. And Sarah, safe travels. Maybe by the time you get back, Facebook and Instagram won't actually believe that I'm a spam bot anymore.
I hope they figure it out that you're like a real person and not a Russian bot real fast.
I'm approaching my 8-year anniversary with these same social media tools. So listen, let's get it together. Clearly, I have not been spamming the internet. I didn't work on, you know, building this material for 8 years in order to just spam them this week. It's not, wasn't my plan.
All right, but also, you don't need to go through any of these details to the 8th graders.
Are you sure?
They don't need to hear the word spam bot.
I did include one bullet that says you have to have a good host and a good developer for when you get hacked.
and all of the firewalls and all of the things.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Okay. That's enough of that. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again soon.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
I have really good news.
I love good news. What's your good news?
I figured out how to get around Instagram thinking that I was a spam bot, which isn't as good news as Instagram no longer thinks that I'm a spam bot, but I can Instagram again, so that's exciting.
Hang on. Because there's like the part of this news that I'm like, wait. Instagram decided you're like a Russian spy robot program?
I don't know what they think, honestly.
It's all the political commenting you do on Instagram?
No, it's not at all.
Can't be. But somehow you triggered their little whatever their algorithm is for detecting that.
Sorry. But not actually, I'm trying not to use that word. I know that must have been frustrating.
When you say sorry, it's very Canadian, so it makes me feel right at home. So
anyway, let's move on. You know I have thoughts about that.
And I described the difference between Canadians and Americans. This is like blooper material now. If Canadians are going through a crowd, we're like, sorry.
I know.
Sorry.
literally,
like, Americans go through the crowd. They go, excuse me. But Canadians go, I'm sorry.
Like, what are you sorry for? We've had this conversation.
I'm sorry that you're in my way.
That's not an apology.
Okay. But that's what Canadians mean. Yeah, it's just a different.
Oh, I know what they mean, and what they mean is not a sincere apology. So
no, I mean, I'm sorry that you have to get out of my way because you're in my way.